And hello once again, and welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI. We are broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus. We are also on the web at kuci.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and I am delighted to be here today, as I am every week, actually. Writers on Writing features authors, editors, poets, and literary agents discussing the art and the business of writing. And today my guests are mystery authors Russell Andrews, a.k.a. Peter Gethers, or Peter Gethers, a.k.a. Russell Andrews, and Peter Robinson. First up is Russell Andrews. Russell Andrews is the pseudonym for Peter Gethers. He's a novelist, screenwriter, and author of the best-selling nonfiction trilogy, The Cat Who Went to Paris, A Cat Abroad, and The Cat Who'll Live Forever. Under the name of Russell Andrews, he's the author of two previous best-selling thrillers, Icarus and Gideon. He is now at work on completing his fourth Russell Andrews thriller, Midas, which Mysterious Press will publish in January 2005. He's an editor for a large New York publishing house, and he divides his time between his homes in Lower Manhattan, Sag Harbor, and Sicily. His new thriller is Aphrodite, published by Mysterious Press. Hi, Russell.
How are you, Barbara?
Or Peter.
Good to talk to you again. I'm not actually seeing you.
This is very interesting. We were talking about this a little just before we went on about...
The whole pseudonym problem?
Yeah, being Peter Gethers, who writes nonfiction books, who I imagine writes screenplays and other stuff, and is an editor, and then Russell Andrews, your pseudonym for your thrillers.
Clearly, I'm a hopeless schizophrenic.
Well, talk about that. Why Russell Andrews?
Well, it started for a couple of reasons. I mean, the main reason that I switched is because the cat books were really kind of big bestsellers. And they're very sweet and, I think, nice books and have a definite and quite large audience. And then when I started writing thrillers, the thrillers are filled with gratuitous sex and violence and are kind of dark, and it's not really for the cat audience. So I decided to pick a pseudonym and sort of change my identity in a way. And I have to say, I think it's a little bit cool. I like writing these books because they sell a lot, and people kind of read them, but no one really knows it's me, although in this one, it's the first time they actually say it's me in the author bio.
No.
Not that actually anyone cares if it's me, it turns out, but they say that it's me.
So... The cat books and your thrillers, for instance, Aphrodite, that your current thriller.
Right.
Do you think, I mean, if your cat readers knew that this was you, do you think they would not, there wouldn't be a crossover?
No, I don't think there would be a huge crossover. I mean, some people like both. I mean, I certainly would read both, but I just think it's a really different audience. And in some ways, you know, I wouldn't have wanted someone expecting to find the sensitive me if my name was on these books, because that's not what you're going to get. So I thought, in a way, it would have been cheating the audience a little bit.
Talk about this book and how Aphrodite and your other thrillers came about.
Well, I can tell you specifically about Aphrodite, because I think it's particularly interesting, and it'll sound a little bit like name-dropping, but it isn't, because, unfortunately, this is my life. It came about, I think when you write thrillers, what happens is sort of cool ideas come to you, and then you try to connect them and figure out if they make sense as a plot. And in this one, I got a whole series of what I thought were cool ideas that suddenly and eventually came together. The first one was I got a call from a very good friend of mine who's a screenwriter named William Goldman. And Bill called me because, and this is true, there was an obituary in the New York Times about an actor, an old actor who died. And it listed all these famous films and famous roles that he'd had. And Bill called me because he'd never heard of the guy, and neither had I. So he went on IMDb.com, the movie website, and the guy didn't exist, or he did, but his roles didn't exist. And to make a long story short, it turned out all the information in the obit was wrong. It was kind of a fake obit, and he'd lied to his family for years, and they put in the wrong information. And I thought, well, that's a weird, interesting thing, a fake obit in a newspaper. So I kind of tucked it away. And then you mentioned that I'm an editor at a publishing company. I was editing a book and publishing a book by ex-President Jimmy Carter.
Mm-hmm.
It was a book called The Virtues of Aging. And by the way, as I'm getting older, there are no virtues to aging, I decided, but that's
what about wisdom?
But Carter told me, and there's a chapter in the book, and we had this lengthy discussion. He basically said the fastest growing segment of society are people over 80. And he said it's a financial disaster because as people live past 80 and now they're living past 100, the country can't afford it, and Social Security is going to go broke the longer people live, so the government's in a dilemma. And I thought, well, that's kind of an interesting thing. Then I happened to learn a few things about the pharmaceutical business, and I suddenly tied them all together and came up with a book, Aphrodite, which is really about a government conspiracy with the pharmaceutical companies. And what it basically is, I don't want to give too much away, it's really about what happens if a pharmaceutical company discovers what in essence is a fountain of youth, as is really happening with growth hormones and things like that. People really are living longer. What if they really can prolong life? What does a government do? Because they can't tell people that they're forbidding this drug to come on the market, because who would vote for a government that won't let you live longer? But they can't allow it to happen because they'll go broke. And that, I sort of turned that, when you write thrillers, you have to have a kind of paranoid mind, and I turned it into a kind of paranoid conspiracy and came up with a character who gets, an innocent man who gets caught in the middle of all this.
Interesting.
And so what I think you do is you kind of take real-life events and sort of, you know, depending, I tend to think politically, and this is a kind of political thriller, which is what Russell Andrews is becoming a little bit known for. And so I turned it into a sort of Ludlam-esque conspiracy thriller.
Interesting. So you had your idea, you had your basic premise. Then what? I mean,
Well, then what you do, or what I did anyway, and yeah. I think a lot of writers work this way, is then you have to come up with a character. What I did was I came up with character and setting. And I live in a little town, or part-time live in a little town called Sag Harbor in Long Island, and I like it a lot. And during the summer, it's a bit of a resort town. And what they have during the summer are these young summer cops who are all in their early 20s, and they all wear these Keanu Reeves kind of sunglasses, and they walk around and they think they're really cool, and they don't have guns, they have cell phones in their holsters. And they're incredibly annoying because all they do is give out parking tickets, but they think they're, you know, LAPD. And so I came up with a guy who's not 21 but in his late 30s, who's kind of out of shape and older than these other guys and very taciturn. And all these other kids kind of make fun of him. His name is Justin Westwood, and they call him Eastwood, taunting him because he's so unlike Dirty Harry. And I kind of like the idea of this guy in with these kids, and what it turns out, of course, is that he's not what they think he is. He's someone with a past who's actually the super cop who's been in hiding for years because of something that had happened to him. And so it sort of sprang from being really annoyed by these kids who kept giving me a parking ticket every time I backed up on Main Street in Sag Harbor. And then the character developed, and you try to come up with really interesting twists. And, you know, the idea of a cop who's led a hard life, who's hiding from things, who's been done to death, but it's still an interesting guy. So what I did was I tried to come up with a few unique twists and turns to his character that as I came up with them, also affected the plot.
Yes. Okay, so you have your plot, you have your character. And is that the typical way you begin with a theme, a plot?
I think so. I mean, it can work. You know, sometimes you come up with a character first. In this instance, I really came up with the basic premise first and then fit a character into it. And I'm kind of a Hitchcock fan, and I think whenever I write thrillers, if there's one common link of the Russell Andrews thrillers, it's I like the idea, which Hitchcock did all the time, of an innocent man getting caught up in something he doesn't quite understand.
Mm-hmm.
It's always really appealing to me because I think it's really frightening when you don't actually know what's going on. It's the unknown that's frightening. And so that's what I've done in all three of the thrillers. And And in this one, basically came up with a cop who didn't really want to be a cop anymore. He wanted to work in this little resort town, stay away from violence. He wanted to escape his violent past, who suddenly finds himself unable to escape it, and he doesn't know why, and all he knows is he's got to figure this out or someone's going to kill him.
Interesting. I wanted to ask you, well, and first I want to say again that I'm here today with Russell Andrews, author of Aphrodite, published by Mysterious Press, and that the views and the opinions that you hear on the show are those of me and my guests and not those of the University of California Regents. Anyway, I wanted to ask you about dialogue because you do it so well, and it's authentic.
I love coming on your show, Barbara.
And it's authentic to the characters. It sounds like these people. Will you talk about that, about writing dialogue? Because it does seem to be one of the more difficult things.
Well,
it's really
funny. In a way, I'm a bad person to talk about that because I think, again, I'm also an editor. And probably the biggest flaw when I get books, particularly from not professional writers, is people can't write dialogue. It is the hardest thing to do. And strangely enough, it's absolutely the easiest thing for me to do. It's the thing that comes most natural to me, and to be immodest, I think I'm really good at it. And part of it, I think, is my father was a screenwriter and television writer, and so I grew up really from the age of 7 and 8 years old reading screenplays, which is basically reading dialogue. And I've written over the last 20 years or so a lot of television and a lot of movies, so I've just written a lot of dialogue, and in prose, it just comes to me really easily. I think the key is it's a combination of things. I think when writers are starting out, they always make the mistake of putting too much information in dialogue, and that's not the way people speak. You know, people go, I'm trying to think of an off-the-top-of-my-head example of flawed dialogue, but people always say, oh, hi, Bob, it's good to see you. You're my brother, and I haven't seen you in 3 years. You know, that's really that's an exaggeration, but that is what people do in essence. And I think, you know, the best dialogue writer, arguably, in the history of novels is Elmore Leonard. And when you read his dialogue, it's so natural because it's so incredibly sparse. There's not one extra bit of information in it. He also doesn't use adverbs, which I really admire, because I overuse them. But, you know, I think sparseness is the key, and making it natural and really figuring out a way to have people talk the way people really talk.
Yeah. Yeah, so not trying to inform the reader on all kinds of things that they should just know from reading the book.
Yeah, exactly. You know, you have to figure out another way to do that. People tend to cram too much into dialogue. They tend to cram plot in. They tend to cram character analysis. And, you know, it depends what kind of book you're writing, obviously. And, you know, sometimes dialogue. I'll tell you who writes really good dialogue. A writer I've been reading who I like is Richard Russo. I don't know if you ever read him.
Sure.
But he writes terrific dialogue because he can be, I mean, the hard thing to do, which I have to say I like to do, and I think I can do it, it's very hard to be funny in dialogue. And I write a lot of comedies for movies, so it comes kind of naturally to me. Hmm. But, you know, I think the key to good dialogue is to make it natural, and sometimes people are funny, and sometimes people are philosophical, and sometimes people are sullen and terse, and, you know, you just have to try to capture it all. And the other key is you have to actually have different voices. People talk differently. And when you read bad novels, everybody sounds the same. Everybody talks the same and uses the same language, and that's not the way it works in real life.
Sure.
So you have to, you know, you have to figure out, it's really dialogue is part of figuring out what a character is, where the character's from. People in New England don't talk the same way as people from the South, but you can't caricature it. You know, you don't want to write dialogue and have someone from the South every other word saying y'all, because it's not the way they talk. But they still talk differently than someone in New England or someone in California or something like that.
Yeah.
And so you really have to think that all the way through and be consistent.
Hmm. What about, again, the fact that you write various genres. You write the thriller, you write these nonfiction
I've written
cat
sort of
books.
Real novels, too. Not that the thrillers aren't real novels, but I've written non-thriller novels
okay.
under my name also.
See, I don't know about those. You do so much.
Unfortunately, nobody knows about those, Barbara. That's why I write thrillers now.
So, but how do you do all this? I mean, how do you switch hats so thoroughly and just...
I take huge masses of drugs.
Other than that.
Because, you know, writers used to do this. And although I'm getting older, I'm not old enough to have lived through this era. One of the things I regret, I really wish that I could have lived through the era where people wrote for mystery magazines and science fiction magazines and pulp novels and radio dramas and stuff like that, because I really think writing, unfortunately I'm not a genius writer, I'm one of those craftsman writers, and I really admire craft. And so I like the idea of writing different genres. It's what's appealing to me, because it gives me a chance to sort of master different kinds of craftsmanship. I mean, not that I've mastered it, but that's the attempt. And I hate the fact that one of the things that's wrong with publishing today, or films today, too, is people want to lump you into one sort of thing. You can only write comedy, or you can only write thrillers, or you can only write romance. And it's not what writers do, or not what writers should do.
Yeah.
So I really love writing thrillers. I'm not going to only write thrillers the rest of my life. After Midas, in fact, I have a sort of more serious novel that I'm going to be finishing. But, I think it's what writers should do.
Hmm. Now, in terms of also being an editor and having this knowledge of the publishing industry that most writers don't have, how does that affect writing?
I try actually not to let it affect the writing. I think it's helped me over the years, because as an editor, I do some rewriting with people, and I've learned a lot from almost everybody I've edited. And it's funny talking about writing in different genres. I also edit a huge kind of different variety of books. My taste is very eclectic, so I've edited really, really serious, award-winning, intellectually oriented nonfiction, and I've edited really pulpy novels and very frivolous books and really funny books, and that's my taste. And I like to think I've actually learned from a lot of... I've worked with, you know, probably 50 superb writers in my career, and I think I've probably picked up something from each of them. But the key is not to imitate them and find your own voice. And then I think the other thing, when you know too much about publishing, is sort of to forget what you know. Like, I know that I'm going on book tour next week, and we'll be touring up and down California, and I know, because I've been in publishing a long time, that I'm going to go into a bookstore and my book's not going to be there. And writers get really aggravated when that happens, because publishers are, for the most part, you know, incompetent. And but I don't get aggravated, because hey, I've been a publisher and I've been just as incompetent. I'm exaggerating slightly, obviously. I love my publisher, in case they're listening. But most publishers are incompetent. And, you know, that's what happens. So I think what you have to do is, one, I put the knowledge to use so I don't get too aggravated when there are a lot of screw-ups. And also just, you know, I'm not that concerned with sales. And I think that probably comes from having been in publishing. My job is to write the book, and I get paid for it, and that's fine. And I really love the process. And once it's published, it's out of my control. And I think having been a publisher, it lets me let go a little bit easier. Once the book's published, my job is actually to write the next book and forget about this one.
Now, that's interesting that you say that, because there are all these books coming out, or that have been coming out, on, you know, how to publicize your own book and how publicists at publishing companies don't do anything, and or they do so little because they have their hands full. They have just, you know, their inbox is overflowing with things they need to do for all, you know, these millions of authors, so that writers I know are feeling more and more pressured to do their own publicity or hire somebody.
Yes, and obviously, I'm doing publicity now, and I'm going to do it, and it comes with the territory. I think if you, these days, if someone pays you money to write a book, part of the job is to publicize it the way actors publicize movies, because it's harder and harder to sell books. So I think it does come with the territory, and I'm happy to do it, and I think most writers are actually happy to do it. I think it's not, I mean, publishers are not totally incompetent, and they're actually, I mean, I'm serious, I think my publisher is just excellent, and they're doing a great job. But, yeah, the business is getting harder, and it's harder to get personal attention from people, and publishers literally publish more than, you know, a lot of the big New York publishers publish way more than a book a day. And so it's very hard to get individual attention, and if you can figure out a way to get your own publicity and to help marketing, more power to you. But on the other hand, I think you can't become obsessed with it. Your job is really to write the book, and if you can help sell it, great. But to then, you know, it depends on the kind of book you're writing. If you're writing a hypey book that's strictly there to be marketed and sold, that's one thing. But if you're writing something that you take a little bit seriously, or you're a writer who wants to write 10 more books, you know, just write the book. Books tend to find markets if they deserve it.
You sound so so optimistic, which is refreshing.
No, I just think it's not even optimism. I just think there are too many things that are out of your control.
Yeah.
What I can control is the writing.
Yes.
That's what I do. I can't control the publicity or the advertising or the marketing, and I think you can't become obsessed with it. It's not your job. You know, your job is to write. And I think when you get too obsessed with the other things, you stop doing what you should do, and probably you're not writing as well as you can write.
Sure. You are listening still to Writers on Writing, and I'm here today with Russell Andrews, author of Aphrodite. So do you think you should push, as a writer, should you push your strengths or weaknesses?
Well, I don't understand the question.
Well, I mean,
you mean should you write into your strengths?
Yeah,
or should you
really focus? Yeah, or should you focus on what you're not good at and try to do that better? You know, I mean,
well,
like,
I think it's a combination of both. You know, it's, I mean, it would be pretty boring if you only wrote what you were good at. I mean, the thing is, writing, which people forget, writing is actually incredibly difficult. And, you know, because I'm both a writer and a book publisher, I can't go out in public without somebody saying, oh, I'm writing a book, will you read a book? You know, I'm going to write a book. And after a while, since I've done this for quite a few years, at some point I hear someone say, you know, I've got a great book in me. You know, if I only had the time, I would do it. And basically my attitude is, well, shut up about it then. Either sit down and do it or be quiet.
Right.
Because writing is actually really difficult. And if everybody thinks they have a book in them, and the thing is, everybody does have a story in them, but that's different from having a book.
Hmm.
And, you know, it's always weird, I think, people just sit down and think they can write. And it's not so dissimilar from saying, you know what, I think I'm going to perform brain surgery tomorrow, even though I've never done it. That's obviously not quite as technical, but in fact, it requires a pretty long time. You have to be a reader. There are things you have to study. You know, again, unless you're James Joyce, unless you're just a genius and smarter than everybody, you have to learn craft, you have to know how to write dialogue, you have to actually know how to tell story, which is the thing that is most confounding to people. Story is hard. You have to know, even if it's a really, really serious book, how to make people turn the pages. And it's just not that easy. So, you know, on the other hand, I mean, it's the whole point, the reason I'm going off on this complete, what sounds like a complete tangent, is you never can write something perfectly. I don't care what your strengths are. You always can get better, even when you're good at something.
Yes.
And so I think the thrill of writing is it's actually impossible, unless you're maybe Ford Madox Ford or someone, to write a perfect novel. And so the better you get at something, the more thrilling it is, because you get closer. But it would be boring if you only concentrated on what you were good at. So I think you have to work on weaknesses. And I mean, my weakness up until recently, I think, was always story. It's why I never had the nerve to write a thriller, because it's really hard to concoct something that moves forward at the pace you want to move it forward at.
Yeah.
And it took me a long time to sort of figure out how to do that. And now I think I've actually learned.
Hmm.
But it took years.
Sure. Now,
that makes sense.
Yes, you've been making quite a lot of sense.
I'm not just babbling incoherently.
No, unless I'm incoherent as well and understand your babble. But I think you're making a whole lot of sense and saying things that writers need to hear, actually.
Well, you know, people just don't talk about things like that. And it's why things like, writers meeting and getting together at writers' conferences and things like that is good, because it's good to talk about this stuff, right? Writing is also actually a pretty lonely profession. You know, you're just sitting in front of your computer screen 6 or 8 hours a day, and it's comforting to hear that it's torture to write, or that, you know, when I'm writing a book, every 15 minutes I'll get up and raid my refrigerator, vacuum or something, you know, anything to avoid writing. But of course, the thing about writing is so much of the process is actually thinking.
Yeah.
You know, I could be staring at the wall for 6 hours, and that could actually be writing, even though at the end of those 6 hours, I'll sit down and do a page.
Hmm.
But it took me that long to come up with that page.
Yes.
So, you know, sometimes you look like you're doing nothing, but the fact is you're working kind of hard.
Hmm.
At least that's what I tell people anyway.
It makes sense to me. Tell us where you're going to be in Southern California. Are you going to be down here?
I'm doing a signing in La Jolla at Warwick's Bookstore.
Yes.
Which is a great bookstore on Tuesday, the 17th of this month.
Okay.
I'm going to be in Los Angeles at Dutton's Bookstore on the 15th.
Excellent.
The La Jolla at Warwick's, it's in the evening, I think 7 o'clock, and at Dutton's on the 15th, which is a Sunday. I think it's 2 p.m. in the afternoon.
Okay.
And I'm also at a mystery bookstore somewhere, but I have no idea where.
Hmm. I wonder if, there's a few of them, so I'm not going to guess, but...
I don't know.
Thank
you.
I'd
like to tell you, but I don't have my schedule in front of me.
Well, thank you so much for coming on again. And I hope with your next book you'll come on again in 2005.
Always.
January.
Book me now.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you so much. As always, that was great to talk to you.
Great to talk to you, too.
Bye-bye.
That was Russell Andrews, author of Aphrodite. And he has other books under the name of Peter Gethers. So check him out. And do stay tuned. We'll be back with Peter Robinson. Don't go away.